those who had me in their home. And I especially want to express my appreciation to Russ and Kay and their kids, and they've just been great. Kay hadn't fed me any food or anything, but aside from that, she said, "No, that's not true. That's a little private thing." But I just have so appreciated the opportunity to be with them. Kay's family had the dubious distinction of marrying into the pickup family. Kay's sister married my brother, and so I mean, if you marry into the pickup family, you are in trouble. Let me tell you what. But I just appreciate them and appreciate everybody here. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Somebody asked me during the break, "How's your voice doing?" You can tell it's not doing real good. But I've preached with a worse voice than this. So if you can bear with my raspiness, I want to talk with you tonight in this final lesson regarding the question of, did Jesus really rise from the dead? I told you before, if I just had one lesson to preach to somebody, it would be this. Because as we have said, Jesus made some absolutely amazing claims. Jesus claimed, according to Matthew chapter 28, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." Think about that. This man is saying all authority has been given to him in heaven and on earth. That is either the most outlandish, braggadocious, conceited statement of exclusivism that anybody could ever utter, or it's the truth. And if that bold statement is the truth, then you better be able to back that one up. And that's what we need to understand, that the first century preachers of the gospel were affirming. That's what Jesus himself affirmed. He knew that his statement to be the Son of God, to be sent from heaven, to have all authority, he knew that that was absolutely a statement that excluded other teachers as not being the absolute authority. That was his role. And if Jesus is saying he has all authority, then it means that while other teachers and other religious leaders might from time to time have some good things to say, it would only be good if it conforms to what Jesus said, because he's the real authority. And so he's the one you really should be following, not somebody else. And that kind of exclusivism is something that you better be able to back up with some serious evidence. And Jesus knew that. And that's why he said, if I don't do these miraculous works, then don't believe me. If these miracles that the eyewitnesses are alleging that they saw Jesus do on repeated occasions, if those are not really what happened, then Jesus, by his own mouth, was saying, don't accept this. Yet Jesus was saying that his bold claim was something that he proved by means of his miracles. And the ultimate miracle, Jesus himself and his apostles said, would be Jesus' own resurrection from the dead. That's why I say to you that the evidence for this one miracle is even greater than the evidence for all the others. And that's why Jesus and the New Testament writers said that this was absolutely paramount. Here's the real fundamental basis for our faith. Acts 17, 30 and 31. Here the text says that Paul taught this in the midst of the Areopagus. "Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed." There's another one of those outlandish, exclusivistic statements. God's going to judge the world through this one man? Also, that's exactly what the gospel of Jesus is affirming. But look at the rest of the sentence. "Having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. Now, if Jesus was really raised from the dead, then we can have confidence, yes, he is going to be the judge of all men on that last day. And notice Paul rests everything upon the factuality of that alleged event, that this dead man rose again. That's exactly what Paul affirmed to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. When Paul was recounting to them what he had taught them a few years earlier when he had established that congregation of Christians there at Corinth. He said, I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that He was buried, and that He was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. After that, He appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then He appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as it were, to one untimely born, He appeared to me also. Paul talks here about four things that he delivered to them as of first importance. You want to have a sermon on fundamentals? This is the most fundamental you can get. Paul says, as of first importance, he preached to the Corinthians that Jesus died, that He was buried, that He was resurrected from the dead on the third day. And don't stop there like we sometimes do. He said a fourth thing, that He appeared to witnesses. And that fourth thing is the proof of the ultimate affirmation that Jesus, the one who died and was buried, was resurrected from the dead. How do you know that? Because here were witnesses who saw this dead man alive again starting that third day after his crucifixion. And Paul even lists several of those witnesses in those verses that we just read. Folks, we need to understand that New Testament Christianity is absolutely unique among the religions of the world in the fact that it is very willing to confidently allow everything to rest upon the historicity of this one claim, that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead. If that really didn't happen, the Apostle Paul says, don't be a Christian. In Newsweek magazine articles, in Time magazine articles, in all these documentaries on television, the issue is always, well, did the resurrection really happen? And that's the debated thing. And you have various people, even some who claim to be Christians, and they say they don't believe that Jesus really was resurrected from the dead. Yet they say, I'm a Christian. Folks, you cannot be a Christian according to the New Testament and deny that the resurrection really happened. In fact, the Apostle Paul said this back in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is vain. Moreover, we are even found to be false witnesses of God. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it sadly ironic that people even today can buy into the modernistic denial of the supernatural and yet, with the other hand, still try to hold on to Christianity and say, well, I'm a Christian, but they deny that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Paul says, if that didn't really happen, if it's not really true that that dead man was raised on the third day, then our preaching is absolutely vain. And in fact, Paul says quite candidly, we're false witnesses. We're liars. We've given false testimony. He says, our preaching is vain. Your faith is worthless. He goes on to say, just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. Folks, Christianity crumbles if this did not really happen. And New Testament preachers of the gospel were quite willing to allow everything to rest upon the evidence for this one alleged miracle. Well, I want us to look at all that today. What do the witnesses allege? I think most of us here know the basic testimony of the witnesses recorded there in these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They talk about how Jesus was arrested by the Jews. He was taken before the Jewish Sanhedrin Council in the middle of the night and appeared before Annas and appeared before Caiaphas and all of the Sanhedrin Council. And they ultimately, the high priest rends his garments when Jesus is asked the question, "Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" And Jesus, under oath, as it were, says, "Yes, I am. You've said it yourself." And the high priest, Caiaphas, rends his garments and accuses Jesus of the height of blasphemy. And they deliver him over to the Roman soldiers to take him to Pilate. And then Pilate adjudicates him. He's briefly sent to Herod Antipas for Herod to judge his case. He's sent back to Pilate. And finally, Pilate washes his hands of the matter and allows him to be scourged. Allows him to then be nailed to that cross. And then the witnesses talk about how his body was taken down from that cross after it was verified that he truly was dead, a spear thrust into his dead corpse, outflowing blood and water, verifying that he was dead. His corpse was taken down from that cross, and Nicodemus helped Joseph of Arimathea bury Jesus' body in that tomb of Joseph. And then the texts say, the witnesses allege that a guard was placed around that tomb the next day to prevent anyone from coming and stealing the body and perpetrating some kind of a hoax. And yet on that third day after Jesus' crucifixion, the witnesses allege that when the women came to the tomb, the stone was rolled away and the tomb is empty. There is no body of Jesus. There are some burial garments there laying inside the tomb, but the body of Jesus is gone. There's a young man that says to the women, he's dressed in white apparel, and he says, "Why do you look for the living among the dead?" He says, "Behold, he's going before you to Galilee. Tell that to the disciples." And then what you see are the witnesses who begin to, or their testimony is then related, the various witnesses who talk about having seen that the tomb was empty and then having had Jesus appear to them. We don't know the particular tomb that Jesus was buried in. We don't know that, but we do know the kind of tomb. In fact, these tombs, hewn out of solid rock, they're all over that area of Palestine and Judea and Galilee. In fact, here's a diagram of a first century tomb that was discovered just south of Jerusalem just a few years ago. And here's an overhead shot of it. I want to just give you some information so you can appreciate what the witnesses are saying about the tomb of Jesus. These tombs would be hewn out of solid rock, and there would be an entranceway, and then there would be these projections. You can see those finger-like projections there. Those are called loculi, and that's where the various bone repository boxes would be placed so that several generations of a man's family could be buried in these tombs. Here's a photograph of the inside of this tomb, and that flat area would be where a new corpse would be laid, and then the tomb would be covered up, and then the body would be allowed to decay, and then about a year later, the Jewish family would come back and gather those skeleton bones and put them in an ossuary box, and those ossuary boxes would then be placed in these loculi, these projections there, and so you could have several generations that would be kept there in these tombs. The biblical record says this was the Jesus' tomb was the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, and it was a new tomb. Jesus was the first person who ever was placed in that tomb. And the witnesses then give their testimony about having seen Jesus. And that testimony is recorded. And when you look at all the evidence from the Gospels and then from Paul's record, what you see is the claim that Jesus appeared to Mary first of all, and then to the women who were with her a little bit later, to two disciples on the road to Emmaus, to Simon Peter later that same afternoon, to the apostles, that is, the apostles without Thomas, later that day in the upper room. And all of these initial post-resurrection appearances all claim to have occurred on that very day of Jesus' resurrection, that Sunday when He was raised from the dead. And then John's testimony says a week later, the following Sunday, Jesus appeared again to the apostles, this time all 12. This time Thomas was present with them. And Thomas, who had been incredulous before, sees Jesus and sees that he's alive from the dead, sees the wounds in his body, but he is now alive. It's a miracle. And he says, "My Lord and my God." And then what you see are the testimony regarding various post-resurrection appearances up in Galilee. First of all, to the apostles by the Sea of Galilee, to the apostles on a mountain in Galilee. Paul talks about, on one occasion, 500 disciples at one time. Maybe that's the same incident as the previous one to the apostles on the mountain, but in any case, he is said to have appeared to James, his half-brother, and that obviously is what causes James to then become a believer in Jesus. And then he appeared to the apostles back in Jerusalem. That last appearance over a 40-day period, according to the testimony. Over a 40-day period, and Jesus then appears toward the end of that period back in Jerusalem with his apostles. He walks with them across the Kidron Valley to the top of the Mount of Olives, just outside of Jerusalem. And that's where the witnesses say they saw Jesus ascend up into the sky. There was one more post-resurrection appearance, according to the testimony, to Paul or Saul of Tarsus. An individual who was not a disciple of Jesus, who was not a believer in Jesus initially, but a persecutor of those who were Christians. And yet Paul's testimony is that on the road to Damascus, he saw the resurrected Jesus and was commissioned to then be an apostle of Jesus. And 3 days later, Ananias comes to him in Damascus and urges him, "Why are you waiting? Why don't you be baptized and wash away your sins?" And he was that very hour. And so this is what the witnesses are alleging. This is what the testimony is in a nutshell. Well, modern skeptics, they don't want to accept this evidence that you see in the Gospels and in Paul's writings. Well, what do they say in response? I have people always asking me, what do these modern skeptics who deny the historicity of Jesus' resurrection, what do they say in response to all of this evidence regarding Jesus and His miracles, and especially the evidence of His resurrection? Well, you know what a lot of them say? They say nothing about it. Let me give you one example. This is a book by Jacob Neusner, A Rabbi Talks with Jesus. Jacob Neusner is a world-renowned professor of Judaism. He's probably one of the two top professors of Judaism in the world today. He's a former professor of mine, and he's a man that I'm very happy to call friend. He's not a Christian. He's a rabbi. He's a practicing Jew. He has written numerous academic works. He wrote this book several years ago, A Rabbi Talks with Jesus. You might enjoy getting a copy of it. It recently was republished. And in this book, what he does is he writes as if he had been a Pharisee in the first century who had had the opportunity to talk with Jesus and dialogue with Jesus, and he explains in this book why, if he had lived back then and been able to dialogue with Jesus, he would not have become a disciple of Jesus. That's what he explains in this book. But Jacob Neusner makes it very clear at the outset of the book. Now, I'm not going to discuss any of his miracles. I'm just going to explain why I reject Jesus' teaching. And why, if I had lived back then, I would not have become a disciple because I don't agree with his teaching. But he makes it very clear in the book that the alleged evidence concerning his miracles and the evidence concerning his resurrection from the dead, I'm not going to discuss. Well, that's very convenient. And that's exactly what so many people in our world today will say. So many of the academic skeptics, I mentioned John P. Meyer in the previous lesson, world-renowned New Testament scholar who rejects the miraculous, who rejects the resurrection of Jesus. And you know what he says in his book about Jesus? He says in his book that he's not going to discuss the evidence for Jesus' resurrection because resurrection would be a miracle that is outside the purview of a scientific investigation. That's exactly what Jacob Neusner said. And you know what bothers me about that? I know what they mean. What they mean is this. Nobody was in the tomb when Jesus ostensibly came back to life and the corpse was animated. Nobody was there to see that. And that's certainly true. The witnesses don't claim that anybody was. And also what they're talking about is the fact that resurrection is something they say that is on par with other religious doctrines like the Trinity, like other supernatural events that they say are beyond the scope of the empirical realm and therefore cannot be investigated by a scientist or by an historian because they're outside the realm of the empirical. They're not part of what we can perceive with our senses. Resurrection is not what we can perceive with our senses, Meyer says. Just like the Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, cannot be perceived with our senses. And therefore, they very conveniently say, I'm not going to consider any of the alleged testimony about Jesus' resurrection. Now, Jacob Neusner is my friend, but on this one, I believe he's absolutely being intellectually dishonest. I'd say the same thing about John P. Meyer and all of those who conveniently don't discuss the evidence for the resurrection. Folks, it's true that the resurrection and how that could be accomplished is outside the empirical realm. But let me tell you what's not outside the empirical realm. When there's a man who is dead, you can perceive that with your senses. And if 3 days later, that dead man is now alive again and talking with you and you can touch him and he's eating a meal with you, that's in the empirical realm. That's something that can be verified as an historical event just like any other. I think it's intellectually dishonest for these men to just ignore that evidence. But that's exactly what they do. They don't discuss it. And they massage their intellect to make it seem like they have a valid reason to ignore that evidence. I believe that's intellectually dishonest. What do you think? Well, we're not going to ignore the evidence. Tonight, we're not going to ignore it. And I want us to evaluate this. I want you to evaluate this. And to me, a very convenient way to evaluate it is like this. That tomb of Jesus was either still occupied by His corpse on that third day after His crucifixion, or it was empty of His corpse. This is one of those either-or issues. You know, not every question is an either-or question. You know, you got to be careful about some of these either-or questions. You know, Marty, have you stopped beating your wife? You know, don't answer that yes or no. You're going to get yourself into trouble. But here is an either-or question. I mean, either His tomb was occupied with His corpse or it wasn't on that third day after His crucifixion. And so what I want us to do is let's look at all the alternatives if it is the case that Christ has not been raised. You know, Paul said, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless. We're false witnesses. All right? Well, if Christ has not been raised, if that didn't really happen, well, then what are the ways to explain what the witnesses are saying and what the data indicates? How can you explain that away? And all of those various theories that people have come up with can all be looked at under two categories. That the tomb was occupied with His corpse or that His tomb really was empty. So let's start with all those alternative explanations of this data that all assume that the tomb really was still occupied with the corpse of Jesus. Well, here's the first view. And we've really already talked about this at great length. This is the view that says, well, you know, all this account of Jesus being buried in the tomb of Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, and all of that account about the burial, all of that's part of this legend. Just like it said that the Gospels are all giving this legendary account that the people honestly thought was true, but it really was just legend. Legends arise around a lot of great charismatic leaders, you know, George Washington. Legends arose about him, like the cherry tree incident. And Davy Crockett had legendary stories arise around him. And that's what people say in regard to all of this. Well, you know, all these accounts in the Gospels, it's just legend. In fact, that's what John Dominic Crossan said in his book, Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. I mentioned that the other night. Everything the Gospels say about Jesus' burial is a myth, according to John Dominic Crossan. That's what he says. It's just a legend that arose over the course of time. And he says, you know, Jesus was probably in actuality never buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. In fact, he probably wasn't even buried in any tomb. The Roman soldiers probably just threw his corpse in a ravine or something. And so all that about this tomb, it's all just part of this legend that arose afterward. Well, that's a real easy way to kind of just dismiss all this with a wave of your hand. But you know what? According to Acts chapter 2, what the witnesses are saying is that the burial of Jesus was part of that gospel message from the very beginning. That's what Acts chapter 2 indicates in its record of Peter's speech on the day of Pentecost. That's the whole point when Peter quotes Psalm 16 and says that the tomb of David just outside of Jerusalem, it's still occupied with David's corpse. And so Peter makes the point that this passage is ultimately to be understood as a messianic prophecy about Jesus and about His resurrection from the dead. And the whole point in all of that is that Jesus' tomb just outside of Jerusalem, it was empty. That's the whole basis for everything that Peter is saying. Now, somebody says, well, that's just what the book of Acts says about that. But the book of Acts is claiming, and the author is saying, he's basing all this on the testimony of the eyewitnesses. He's saying that that burial of Jesus and the empty tomb was part of that gospel message from the very first sermon that was preached. Now, is that just some lie that was concocted? Was that really not part of the gospel message from the very first sermon preached? That's what the evidence indicates. John Dominic Crossan just dismisses all that and just says, I know, that's just, it's all public. But that's not what the evidence indicates. It indicates that the death, burial, resurrection, and appearances of Jesus were from the very beginning. In fact, remember we talked about Paul and his writings and 1 Corinthians 15 that we just looked at the beginning of this lesson. Paul said, as of first importance, he delivered to those Corinthians the fact that Jesus died, was buried. Notice he emphasized that. He was buried. Implies being buried in a tomb of some kind. He was resurrected, and then he appeared to the witnesses. Paul is writing about that 2 decades after Jesus' crucifixion, and he's talking about that as being something that he always had preached as of first importance to the Corinthians and everywhere else. The idea of John Dominic Crossan trying to tell people that the information in the Gospels about Jesus being buried in a tomb and the tomb was empty, well, that's all just some later myth that was kind of tacked on to the Gospel account. I don't believe that's a fair reading of the evidence. Do you? Again, from the very beginning of first importance, the burial of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. In fact, on this point, let me also mention this. Justin Martyr was a second century Christian author who wrote this very interesting piece, A Dialogue with Trypho. It's an account of his discussion with a Jew that he presents in the story, Trypho. And this Jew is an educated, non-Christian Jew who's having a dialogue with Justin about whether or not Christianity is true. So in the course of this, Justin Martyr talks about the Jewish view and how they would try to explain away this evidence regarding Jesus' resurrection. And he's writing this about 165 A.D. "You have sent chosen and ordained men throughout all the world to proclaim that a godless and lawless heresy had sprung from one Jesus, a Galilean deceiver whom we crucified, but his disciples stolen by night from the tomb where he was laid when unfastened from the cross, and now deceive men by asserting that he has risen from the dead and ascended to heaven." Now notice, what everybody acknowledges, even modern scholars who read this, they acknowledge that what Justin Martyr is doing is he's giving an account of what at least he understood Jews were saying to rebut Christianity at that day and time. And notice what is said here is that not that they believed that Jesus' tomb wasn't empty, not that he had never been buried in a tomb at all. No, they acknowledged all of that. They acknowledged he was buried in a tomb. They acknowledged that his tomb was empty. But what they were saying is the disciples stole the body. I'm going to come back to that view in a moment. But what I want you to see here is the earliest opponents of Christianity, they knew this wasn't just some legend. They accepted the fact that, yes, his tomb was empty. No, his body wasn't thrown in some ravine like Crossan says. They accepted that, yes, he was buried in a tomb, and yes, his tomb was empty. If they had been able to argue against that in any way, don't you think they would have done that? But they acknowledged that. But the best they could come up with was the disciples stole the body from the tomb. Folks, this legend view to dismiss the testimony and the evidence regarding Jesus' resurrection, it just doesn't work. And, of course, a lot of people see that it doesn't work. And so they try to say other things. Maybe, okay, Jesus was buried in this tomb, no question about that. But maybe the reason why people thought that his tomb was empty on that third day is that nobody knew the right tomb. Or maybe the people went to the wrong tomb initially. So those are a couple of theories that people have come up with. Do those seem plausible to you? Well, they don't seem too plausible to me. You mean nobody knew the tomb? Joseph of Arimathea didn't know his own tomb? And nobody knew at all where Jesus really was buried? Or even if you're going to, for the sake of argument, say, okay, nobody knew where the tomb of Jesus was, and they went to the wrong tomb, say. And this tomb just happened to be open, and it was empty, and there was no other bodies in there from past generations, and there was burial garments still there, but no corpse. It just happened to be some other tomb, and all that was the case. Or even if you're saying, well, they went to a wrong tomb, and just it was open, but all the rest of stuff is somehow legend or something. But the real problem is they went to the wrong tomb and they thought it was Jesus and there was no Jesus in there. And they said, oh, he's been resurrected. You mean nobody could ever figure out that that was the wrong tomb? You mean the Jewish opponents weren't able to figure out where the right tomb of Jesus was? Keep in mind that Christianity was first proclaimed in Jerusalem, which was the very seat of Jesus' greatest opposition. You mean the Sanhedrin Council couldn't have found where the right tomb of Jesus was? Once these disciples of Jesus started claiming right there in the city, he's been resurrected. Does that really make a lot of sense to you? And that still doesn't address the issue of the post-resurrection appearances. People claiming they saw Jesus alive again after 3 days and for that 40-day period. So here's a view that some people come up with to try to explain away those post-resurrection appearances, that testimony. They say, well, maybe it's a case of mistaken identification. They say, well, maybe, you know, these people, they wanted Jesus to be alive again. They loved him, and now he was gone. And they saw somebody that looked like Jesus, and they mistakenly said, oh, that's Jesus. He's been resurrected. And I'll have to admit to you that sometimes that kind of thing can happen. People can mistake somebody for something else, and for somebody else. In fact, my sister, unfortunately, passed from this earthly life about 4 or 5 years ago. And to this day, sometimes I'll be driving along or walking along a busy street, and there'll be some blonde woman that kind of walks by. Out of the corner of my eye, I kind of catch a glimpse, and just for a quick moment, I think, oh, it looks like Donna. Maybe you've had a similar experience. But folks, the witnesses are not talking about catching some glimpse of Jesus. They're not talking about, you know, Andrew nudging Peter and saying, hey, look over there, way in that crowd, it looks like, couldn't that be Jesus over there? No, they're talking about being right there with Jesus, touching Him, eating with Him, speaking with Him on repeated occasions, numerous witnesses. They're all just mistaken. Is that really plausible? Some people said maybe they all had an hallucination. And, you know, that can happen sometimes with folks. You get in an emotional state and, you know, you think you see something that really isn't there, a mirage or a hallucination of some kind. They all had a hallucination. All these different post-resurrection appearances, all those people had this hallucination. You've got groups of people at the same incident. You mean they had a group hallucination? 500 people at one time, 12 men on one occasion, 11 men on another, 2 men on another. They had the same hallucination. Does that really make a lot of sense? And these hallucinations just stopped after 40 days? Except for one more guy who claimed he saw Jesus after he'd been resurrected from the dead, somebody who never was a disciple of Jesus to begin with, who was very glad that Jesus was dead. He had some hallucination. It just doesn't work, does it? In fact, all of these Occupy Tomb theories that we've talked about up to now, all of these Occupy Tomb theories have a lot of problems, but they all share the same two problems. First of all, unbelieving Jews at the time never produced the body. If the tomb of Jesus still contained his corpse 3 days later, then why in the world didn't the unbelieving Jews just produce the body, show everybody? Here's Jesus, he's not alive again. But they never did. Obviously because they couldn't, because the body was not there anymore. And secondly, all of those occupied tomb theories were never advocated by any of those ancient Jews. I find that very telling. Because the ancient Jews were the ones who most wanted to disprove Christianity. And right there in Jerusalem, that was their area. And that's the very place where the gospel witnesses were giving their testimony. And in order to explain that away or try to rebut that, these ancient Jews never advocated any of the theories we've talked about up till now. Not one. In fact, Michael Grant, I mentioned him the other day, modern historian Michael Grant, acknowledged the points that we've been making here up to this point about the problems with all these occupied tomb theories. He said this, the historian cannot justifiably deny the empty tomb. You just can't deny that. Yes, Jesus was buried in a tomb, and yes, his tomb was empty on the third day. He says, if we apply the same sort of criteria that we would apply to any other ancient literary sources, then the evidence is firm and plausible enough to necessitate the conclusion that the tomb was indeed found empty. He goes on to say, however, this. Who had taken the body? There is no way of knowing. At all events, it was gone. And because it was gone and no one knew where it was, this made it easier for people to believe 3 days later that they were seeing Jesus alive again and returned to the earth, risen from the dead. So Michael Grant acknowledges that none of those occupied tomb theories hold any water. The tomb really was empty. But he says somebody must have taken the corpse. And in his book, he never considers the resurrection possibility. He just ignores that one. Somebody must have taken the body. And he never considers the problems with this idea that somebody took the body. Who could have taken the corpse of Jesus from that tomb? And who would have taken the corpse? Michael Grant says, well, there's no way of knowing, and so we'll just bypass that one. But we're not going to bypass that one. Tonight, we're going to address that. If the tomb of Jesus really was empty, if the body was gone, and if, like Michael Grant and others say, some person or group of people must have stolen that corpse, all right, let's analyze all the possibilities here. And do they hold water? A lot of people say, well, the body was stolen by his disciples to make it look like he'd been resurrected from the dead. That's what the ancient Jews were saying. You recall that? Justin Martyr even talking about that. That's what the Jews, even in the second century, were still saying. Matthew's gospel says that's exactly what the Jews were saying in the first century. That was their position. The tomb was empty, but his disciples stole the body to perpetrate a hoax. I want you to ask yourself that question. How did the disciples manage to get past the guards and steal the body? Would you explain that one? According to the testimony, the tomb of Jesus was being guarded for just that reason, to prevent that very thing from happening. So how did they manage to do that? Somebody says, well, the guards all fell asleep. Well, of course, if you fall asleep on guard duty, you're going to pay with your life. That's kind of the way it worked in the first century. But okay, let's just go with that. They all fell asleep. And you mean not one of them woke up? They were going to take the naked corpse out of the tomb and tiptoe past the guards. And then we're going to go and proclaim to everybody a few days later, he's been resurrected, he's the Lord of life, we're his followers. Does that really make a lot of sense? Well, you know what John Dominic Cross and others do with that? They get around that whole evidence about the guard and the implausibility of all that. They say, well, you know what? Matthew's gospel is the only gospel that mentions a guard at the tomb. Remember that criterion of multiple attestation? So you see, if only one gospel says it, it's not credible enough to accept as really historical, so we just dismiss the guard from being there. Well, that's a nice, handy way to dismiss all that. But you know what, for sake of argument, okay, let's just ignore the guard issue. There was no guard, or however it was, they were able to get that corpse out of the tomb. Now you mean to tell me that then all of this was a purposeful hoax? It was all a hoax to dupe people into thinking that Jesus was the Lord of life. Look at how many people were involved in this hoax, apparently. All of these people were claiming, we saw him alive again from the dead. You mean everybody was involved in this hoax? Boy, this would be a movie that Oliver Stone ought to make, you know, this conspiracy theory. Here's the conspiracy theory to end all conspiracy theories. All these people were involved in this hoax. What did any of them gain if this was all a hoax? What did they possibly gain? What they received because they were proclaiming Jesus as the resurrected Messiah, starting right there in Jerusalem, what they received was beatings, scourgings, imprisonment, and over again, death. There's so many of them. It just doesn't make any sense. And somebody says, well, you know what? Religious fanatics sometimes will even do some of these fanatical things and even die for what really is not the truth. You know, you got people who are fanatics like the Haley-Bopp Comet people, you know, and they commit suicide and think they're going to go live on this spaceship, you know, and all this, you know. And people can do some really, really wild things in their fanaticism. You know, that's true. That's true. But you know what? Those fanatics who even are willing to die for what they're professing, they really believe that what they're professing is the truth. This view is saying these disciples perpetrated a hoax. They knew it was a lie, and they were willing to die for what they knew was an absolute lie. Is that what people do? You ever know anybody to die for what they knew was a lie? I know people that die for what they think is the truth. But are they willing to lay down their life for what they know is an absolute lie? No. And you mean Paul was involved in all of this? How do you explain Paul? Is he part of this conspiracy? There is no scholar, to my knowledge today, no matter how liberal they are, that denies that Paul wrote 2 Corinthians. Nor do I know of any of them who think that Paul was lying when he talked about what he suffered as a result of being a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I've been beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I've spent in the deep. I've been in labor on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I've been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And he went through all of this, and he knew he was just making the whole thing up. Does that make a lot of sense? You know what's interesting, folks? That view that the disciples stole the body, that was a view that a lot of skeptics in the 19th century espoused. And the early part of the 20th century, skeptics espoused that view right there. But as I've already told you, current modern-day skeptics, even they don't try to affirm that view. It's too implausible. It makes no sense that these people would have perpetrated a hoax. They gain nothing for it. No, as I've already pointed out to you, modern-day skeptics, they acknowledge that these first-century disciples of Jesus, they really did believe that He rose from the dead. They were being honest about that. So if that view just doesn't work, well then who could have taken the body? Some people say, well, it was moved by the Jewish or the Roman authorities. Well, the first question I'd ask is, why? Why move his corpse? Isn't that going to make it seem like he got resurrected, which is the very thing you would not want to imply to anybody? But even if you're going to say, well, for some unknown reason, somebody moved his corpse out of the tomb, and that's why people thought, oh, he's been resurrected, his tomb is empty. Well, then why in the world didn't they just produce the corpse and say, on that day of Pentecost, when Peter and the others are preaching him as a resurrected Christ, excuse me, here's his corpse. Fooled you. They never did that. Then there's this final theory some people came up with, called the swoon theory. You know what this theory says? Jesus never actually died on the cross. He went into a coma. He swooned. And they thought he was dead. You ever seen the movie Princess Bride? You know what I'm fixing to say, don't you? This view says Jesus wasn't all dead. He was just mostly dead. All right. Well, this view kind of makes a lot of sense, you know. I mean, that's how people thought he'd been resurrected. What happened was he wasn't quite dead yet. He was kind of in a coma. He was unconscious. And then 3 days later, you know, he comes to consciousness. People say, he's alive again. It's a miracle. He's been resurrected. Well, you know, you first think about that. You think, well, I guess maybe that could have some plausibility until you start pondering that a little bit more carefully. You mean the Roman soldiers messed up in their job of execution? You know, these guys were experts at crucifying people. You mean they just kind of blew it and this guy really wasn't dead yet? They took him down before he was dead. According to the testimony, they even thrust a spear up into his side to verify that he was dead. You mean Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, when they're burying him, that nobody noticed, hey, he's still breathing. But you mean to tell me that then they didn't notice it, but okay, they go ahead and put him in this dark, dank tomb for 3 days, sealed up with that stone, and he gets better? He regains consciousness? And even if you say all that, how in the world did he get out of that tomb? Kind of reach around and kind of move that 1.5-ton stone away. And then here he is. He's this mass of wounds in his hands and his feet and can't even walk and he's crawling and barely alive. And then people say, oh, he's the Lord of life. Does that make a lot of sense to you? These alternative theories, folks, they just don't work. None of them do. Let me bring all this to a close by going back to this first century tomb that we used a few minutes ago to illustrate the kind of tomb that the witnesses are obviously talking about Jesus being buried in. In 1993, this first century tomb, or 1991, pardon me, quite by accident, some workmen stumbled onto this particular tomb just to the south of Jerusalem. They were digging for a parking lot and unearthed and the ground fell away. This was a tomb. And the archaeologists went in there. This was a first century tomb where a Jewish, very important Jewish family was buried. In fact, inside these loculi, there were several ossuaries, several bone receptacle boxes. And the most significant of all of those ossuaries was this very ornate limestone ossuary. And on the side of it, it had the name of the particular family who was buried in there. In fact, there were several family members' bones who were buried in that one ossuary. And among those bones were the bones of a 62-year-old Jewish man. Forensic scientists were able to examined it, and you know how even from current modern shows, all that they can do with forensic science, they were able to examine and determine this was a Jewish man about 62 years of age when he died. And he obviously is the most prominent member of this particular family. And in fact, his name and the name of the family is on the side of that ossuary. And that inscription in Aramaic says, Yehoseph Bar Kapha. That's Aramaic for Joseph Caiaphas. Folks, we talked a little bit ago about archaeology. Let me give you this one last archaeological datum. In 1991, the tomb of Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest, at the time when Jesus was crucified, the tomb of Caiaphas, the high priest, was discovered. The very man who was in charge of the Sanhedrin, the very man before whom Jesus appeared, the very man who said, I adjure you by the living God, tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God, and to whom Jesus said,
Yes, I am. You've said it. The very man who rent his garments and delivered Jesus to be delivered over for crucifixion. That's the Caiaphas of the Gospels, and that's the Caiaphas whose tomb was discovered in 1991. And in all likelihood, the bones of the 62-year-old man in that tomb are the very bones of Caiaphas himself. And I kind of think it's neat that it's this man's tomb, who was very much the opponent of Jesus Christ, it's this man's tomb that we're using today, 2,000 years later, in an evidences series in Atlanta, Georgia, to help people see the kind of tomb in which Jesus was buried and from which He arose and departed. It's kind of nice that after 2,000 years, Caiaphas can kind of be used on the right side of the issue, at least somewhat. And folks, this really kind of brings all that we're talking about into perspective. Who was right? Christ, who claimed to be the Son of God, or Caiaphas, who said, "You're a blasphemer. I'm going to have you crucified." Who was right on that issue? Was Jesus really resurrected from the dead? Or did that not really happen? Was His tomb occupied with His corpse 2 days later, or was it really empty? If it was really empty, is it empty because, or was it empty because He was raised from the dead? Did He appear to these witnesses like the witnesses claim? Or do these other theories hold any credibility in your mind? Folks, if Christ was not raised from the dead, then Christianity is a sham. Paul himself said, "Don't become a Christian. You're a fool if you become a Christian if Christ has not been raised." If Christ has not been raised and you are a Christian, give it up. That's why I said to you the other day, if I did not believe the evidence supported Jesus' resurrection from the dead, I'd stop being a Christian right now. Paul himself says I should do that. So if you don't want to accept the resurrection of Jesus, okay, then be intellectually honest enough to tell yourself and tell other people which of the alternative theories are you going to defend as your theory. All these occupied tomb theories, do any of them explain all the evidence? Do any of them explain all the data? If they don't explain the data, if they don't work, well, how about all the empty tomb theories? Do any of them explain the data? Are any of them credible? Do they explain things? Are any of them what you would want to defend and rest upon? You've got to make the decision, like Marty said. It's up to you. What do you think? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? Was Jesus right in claiming to be the Christ, or was Caiaphas right in claiming He was a blasphemer who deserved to be crucified? What does the evidence indicate to you? I affirm to you that the evidence indicates to me that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And I believe that today. And that's why I'm a Christian. That's the major reason why I'm a Christian. All other reasons pale compared to that one. But you've got to decide for yourself. Do you believe the evidence supports the conclusion that yes, Jesus was raised from the dead on that third day after His crucifixion? If you conclude that the evidence does indicate He was resurrected, then I urge you to act on it. We're not just talking about some intellectual exercise. If Jesus was really resurrected from the dead, that proves His claim to have all authority in heaven and on earth. Are you going to submit to His authority? It's an absolutely outlandish claim unless it's the truth. And if it is the truth, then you must respond. You must submit to Jesus Christ. You must be baptized into Jesus Christ and become a Christian. And like Ananias said to Saul 2,000 years ago, I'm going to say to you, why are you delaying? Arise and be baptized tonight and wash away your sins. Do you believe that Jesus was raised from the dead? If you do, then become a Christian tonight, right now, while together we stand and sing.